allow for some accommodation with the Negroes, whereas against him coming back, and we were against him coming back. We tried to prevail upon him to wait until Botwell had been able to take over the administration of the city and put in the reforms that he indicated that he would do. So but we were not successful. He came back and did not have the support of the Negro community. He sought a license to parade and to put on a demonstration, and Bull Connor refused. So we went out and got 8 or 10 people, and they were all arrested. So the next day, he decided to have another demonstration, and this time, because the 10 people had been arrested, 20 people came out. And then they were arrested. And then when they were arrested, that got a little bit more publicity, although the papers had arranged between them that they'd never put this on the front page of the paper. They play it down. Television can play it up and got around the Negro community. So then he started to get more and more support as more and more of his people were arrested. Then he got himself arrested on Good Friday, so then he stayed in jail over Easter Sunday, and then of course got everybody aroused, the Negro community, and then he came out, and then he started having larger and larger demonstrations, and as more and more people were arrested, the Negro community, the local Negro community, felt that they couldn't let him do all these things by himself, that they'd have to support him. So they started to support him. Then the NAACP, which had been strongly against him going in there and having these demonstrations, they started to feel that they had to support him because they were losing everything to him. And so finally he started getting more and more people to come his way. And then he hit upon the idea of having the children come out. And that's when the thousands of people started to gather. He got this large groups of people out Friday or Saturday, about 2.5 weeks ago. And there was then, of course, with all those children and all those people, there was great danger. The problem at that time was that the white people and the Negro people weren't talking to one another. Many in the Negro leadership didn't know what they were demonstrating about. They didn't know whether they were demonstrating to get rid of Bull Connor, or whether they were demonstrating about the stores, or whether they were demonstrating against the city government. 90% of the people who were demonstrating certainly didn't know what they were demonstrating about, and none of the white community knew what they were demonstrating about. None of the white community would get near the Negro community at that juncture because they felt that they were being disorderly, and so nobody was talking to anybody. And you had all these demonstrations which were getting larger and larger. So then the president sent Burt Marshall down and to Birmingham to see if something could be done about getting people together. First, he went to the Negro community to find out what they wanted. And as I say, that was difficult because a lot of them didn't know what they wanted. And finally, through efforts with Martin Luther King, found out what they wanted, which was to desegregate the lunch house, which was to take the signs off the toilets and the drinking fountains, to have a better hiring system in Birmingham, the department stores, and to hire at least one clerk in one of the stores. So he went back to the white community, to the department store head, majority of whom were branch stores and who had their main offices outside the city, and told them of this, and so they started having meetings. Douglas Dillon and some others called the heads of the big chain. I spoke to some of them and expressed our concern. Burke met with local people in Birmingham, and finally they said that they'd be willing to do some of these things, but that they would want to wait until something else happened in Birmingham. They wanted to have some other desegregation take place before they took the first step. And what they hit upon was the schools. When the schools were desegregated, they said that they would then do these other things. Well, early the schools would be desegregated was September, so the Negroes were unwilling to wait until that happened. And the department store said that they were unwilling to take the first step. So the result was, this was into Monday, Tuesday, and then the demonstrations got larger and larger. And as the demonstrations got into 1,000, of course they got out of hand. Then Martin Luther King preaches nonviolence, and if you're hit, you kneel down and say your prayers and don't hit back, which is all very good. And those who hear him, they follow him exceptionally well, and there is no violence as far as the Negroes are concerned. But the Negro community of Birmingham has probably the toughest group of Negroes in the country. stood on the fringe and they started throwing the bricks and started running through the parks and running into the department stores. And so the situation had gotten completely out of hand. The white community then became, itself became exercised and concerned as to what they should do. And we felt that if we could get the substantial white citizens who owned the ran the financial life of Birmingham behind the department store head, that perhaps we could get the department store heads to move. So they had a meeting down there, and Berg attended it, said that what you were going to have in Birmingham was complete chaos. You would have bloodshed unless something was done, that the Negro demands were quite reasonable, and that they should support the department store heads and urge them to make this agreement. Finally, some of these meetings went to 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and Burke was the only contact between the whites and the Negroes, and finally brought them together, and they, the white financial economic leaders agreed to support the department store heads, and that they would go down the line, and they also would take steps to improve the lot of the Negroes. When that happened, the department store heads said that they would make this agreement. Then we got in touch with Martin Luther King and said that they had agreed to make the agreement. He said, well, I've had businessmen tell me in Albany that they'd make an agreement, and they didn't keep their word, so we're going to go on with the demonstration. So we said to him that you had the demonstrations to accomplish a certain purpose. You accomplish that purpose with, then go on with the demonstration. That would make a great deal of sense. He said, well, I've got to get people out of jail. The only way to get my people out of jail, we then had a couple of thousand in jail, is to have demonstrations so that they have so many people in jail in such a crisis in Birmingham that they let everybody out of jail. This really did make a great deal of sense. But if you had another day of demonstration, you would have had a great bloodshed in Birmingham, and the governor, who would then start moving into Birmingham, would have taken over the city. So you never had anything accomplished. So we were able to prevail upon him to call off his demonstration just really in time, because I don't think there's any question by that Wednesday night the governor would have moved into the city, and he would have had complete control of it, and you would never have had any of these gains. So they call off their demonstrations. Then you had the Saturday night at 10 after 11, you had one stick of dynamite thrown in Martin Luther King's brother's house, and then 30 minutes later, 11:40, you had 8 sticks of dynamite thrown in the Gaston Hotel where Martin Luther King had stayed. The Negroes gathered several thousands when the police came, and the fire department came with the fire hoses. They threw rocks and stones, brought out their knives, and got out of hand. The local police, the sheriff's office, and the police department, by 2 o'clock in the morning, had brought them pretty much under control. Then the governor sent his people in, and his people were game wardens with armbands, and alcohol attack people with armbands, and tough and mean. They had carbines, and they got out of their cars with clubs and had these guns, and the local police asked them to get back, go away, that they had the situation under control, and that they would kill somebody, and they said that's what they were here for. So then they started clubbing the people, beating them, and then the situation got completely out of control for the next 3 hours. And it was finally brought under control about 6 o'clock Sunday morning. Well, the Negroes then felt that they had been betrayed, and all day Sunday, they indicated quite clearly that that night you were going to have a real war in Birmingham. A number of them were armed. They had knives, they had guns, and that they were going after these people with the armbands. And they felt that the governor had come in, taken over the city, and that there was no solution as far as they were concerned. The president then made the determination to send the troops into Alabama, that they would be available to be used in Birmingham if it was felt to be necessary. And he also went on television that night, just before Martin Luther King came back and to make a speech to the Negroes. That changed the whole complexion of the situation, because Martin Luther King then told his people to calm down and stay at home, that the federal government was interested and was going to be active in the situation to protect them. The fact that we moved the troops into demonstrations. Negro lawyers are going to bring a lawsuit, which we may or may not enter also, to try to join the school board from suspending the students. That will have to be worked out, but at least it would appear that the agreement that was made will be kept, at least at the present time. We are optimistic about it. We're not out of the woods as yet, but I think we feel that we have a good chance of having that kept. The lessons that we learned from it are, first, the importance of having some biracial committee in a community. Each one of these local communities and in a state, the Negroes and the whites talking to one another so that they can air their grievances. One of the great problems as far as the Negroes, and we found in the last 2.5 years, is that they feel that there is no solution for what they want to accomplish, that nobody will talk to them. And community after community, we find that to be so, that they don't have there's nobody, if the Negroes feel that they have grievances, there's no place for them to go. Then they want to demonstrate, and they can't get a license to demonstrate. And so that they want to walk down the street, and they're not given a license, and therefore they're put in jail. That exercises the other Negroes. They don't have any place to go, they don't have any place to complain, and they can't forget about it because then they're put in jail. So they feel a sense of frustration, and that's what's growing up in the South and really in the Northern cities. The second thing that we learned, and which I'd like to take up with you today, is the when Burke met with these business leaders in Birmingham and talked to them about hiring Negroes, they looked at the government agencies and said, why should we hire Negroes? You don't hire Negroes. And so we looked at the situation in Birmingham and found that it was really a disgraceful situation as far as the government departments are concerned. That we really had done a very poor job. The Veterans Administration had done well, and there were a number of Negroes that were employed by the post office, but by and large, they were very low grades. There weren't any Negroes that held any positions that anybody could see them, except perhaps somebody to sweep the floor or something like that. But otherwise, they weren't being used as clerks or out front in positions of importance in any of these offices. And so we felt something needed to be done to remedy that and do it quickly. And I talked to a number of you about situation in your own department, and John Macy did a great deal about pulling it all together, and I think we helped the situation down there. But if it's all right, President, I'd like to have maybe Mr. Macy make a report to the cabinet as to what the situation was in Birmingham, what it is in some of these other major cities, and what's been done about it in Birmingham.
Thank you, Mr. President. The facts that we found in Birmingham were not at all encouraging, as the Attorney General has indicated. Aside from the VA and post office, there were approximately 15 Negroes employed out of a total employment of 2,000 in Birmingham. We met with the agency representatives in Birmingham last week and endeavored to identify the vacancies that were available and to move to hire as quickly as we possibly could. I can report that we do have now commitments for 16 positions since last Thursday, 8 of them in Social Security, 6 in Treasury, 1 in GSA, and 1 in the Post Office. This is just a start. Social Security is particularly helpful. They have indicated that they have about 130 vacancies that must be filled in their payment center there by the 15th of July. We work directly with them. The only other agency that has come up with any vacancies at all as a result of these discussions is the Air Force with 4. There is great difficulty in finding qualified Negroes in the Birmingham community. This is a product of the poor educational system, the cultural atmosphere that's existed for a long time. We can't be daunted by this. It's necessary that we join forces, work with the Negro community and with Negro leadership to identify the sources of talent that will meet our qualification standards. I'd like to suggest a program of 6 action steps, which I believe would be helpful with respect to Birmingham. First, I think it's necessary to re-emphasize with our federal representatives in that city that we really mean business. That we can no longer say that because the community doesn't doesn't support this kind of equal opportunity that we're not going to have it in the federal service. Frankly, we found less than a sense of urgency on the part of the federal representatives when we met with them down there. And anything that can be done from the top down to the local representatives needs to be done. We may even need to change some of our local representatives in that community and others. Second, there's need to urge the agency representatives to identify present and prospective vacancies. There's an amazing lack of awareness of any possible vacancies. This was part of our difficulty in trying to determine just what our objectives would be. Third, we need the assistance of the agencies in recruiting. Generally, the feeling is that this is the Civil Service Commission's job, and that's proper, but I think the entire federal community needs to join in publicity, needs to join in emphasizing the good faith of the federal government at the local level and doing something about it. Fourth, I think that in some of the agencies where there are jobs, it may be possible to do a bit of job engineering to change some of the qualification standards so that there will be more doors open to Negroes than has been traditionally the case. Fifth, I think that we could engage in some strategic placement in view of the fact that there are so few Negroes in these agencies. By that I mean positions that have some visibility in the community, positions that will be judged as leadership models in making it possible for Negroes to be placed. And sixth, we need to screen in the agencies where there are Negroes to find what talent exists. We found in Birmingham, for example, that there are 50 postal employees, Negroes, who have college degrees. Now, the bona fides of those college degrees may be under question, but this is something that we need to look at. This would constitute a resource for other agencies to draw upon for higher level jobs requiring a college degree or that level of educational experience. So that, these, it seems to me, are concrete steps we can take in Birmingham. Now, I feel, as I've indicated to the Attorney General, that rather than wait for these other communities to flare up and then react, we ought to move in and analyze the employment situation in each one. We started doing that yesterday, and we have the first facts. I won't take your time to go into them, but let me say that in Montgomery, Nashville, Memphis, Albany, Georgia, Jackson, Raleigh, and Greensboro, where we ran checks yesterday, the situation isn't any better than it is in Birmingham. And again, it's the VA and the post office that have the bulk of the Negroes that are employed. The percentage of Negroes in total employment is very low.
Could you give just some examples? Because I think that is very important to be aware of this, because we have an impossible situation if we try to get these people to do anything.
Well, for example, in Nashville, in Treasury, there are 405 employees, four Negroes in Nashville. And the only one of the four Negroes is over GS-5. He is GS-5. The Labor Department has 64 employees in Nashville and not a single Negro. FAA has 81 in Nashville and not a single Negro. Agriculture, with eight different activities, has 249 employees in Nashville and two Negroes. Commerce has 50 and no Negroes. HEW has 61 and one Negro. The Army has 255 and five Negroes. VA has 998 and 199 Negroes. So,
what about Jackson, Mississippi?
Jackson, Mississippi, HEW has 46 employees, no Negroes. Treasury has 192 employees and two Negroes. Post Office has 456 and 23 Negroes. The Army at the Waterways Experiment Station has 162 employees and 53 Negroes. VA has two installations there. The center has 194 employees and no Negroes. The hospital has 680 and 190 Negroes. Housing, I guess this is in HFA, has 64 employees and no Negroes. Speaking of FHA, it's interesting to note that FHA is housed in Birmingham in the City Hall, on the floor above Bull Connor. That is correct. The hiring is done.
Well, the Negroes obviously in Jackson County compete with the whites. Well, are we going to get that figure improved even with goodwill?
I think we have to examine all of the jobs that we have a far more affirmative recruiting campaign in the Negro schools, work with the schools to see if we can build up the qualifications of those that are graduating. I visited Jackson State College 3 weeks ago and learned that the students there had not taken the Federal Service Entrance Examination, not because they weren't interested, but they didn't want to go to the post office to take the examination, so we're arranging to have the examination conducted there. On the campus.
They won't take it. Now, I put on my jacket out on a consulting basis many months ago, an eminent dean of one of the Negro schools in the South. We have an organized recruiting campaign trying to get Negroes to apply for jobs of professionals within the department. Very frankly, they haven't. They don't want them. And they think if they do take one, they won't get the job. They do get the job, they'll be made to feel miserable because of the relationship, and it's just
the best jobs for Negroes, so.
So we've got to just go out and get them and convince them that we're going to sell them.
We're not going to Negro get this kind of money for this. Even the old jobs, you can't get just a GS-5 with that. You can get up to 4,000.
Yeah, 65,000.
How much?
5,000.
We can't get that job anyplace else, so they ought to be flocking into the government.
Well, actually, Mr. President, in the 7 southeastern states this year, this fiscal year, we've had 2,100 Negroes take the Federal Service Entrance Examination. 86 passed, 2,100.
86?
Yeah. And 28 of the 86 immediately filed to transfer their eligibility to Washington, D.C. or somewhere.
How many of those have
28 of the 86 immediately requested transfer of eligibility to somewhere else, mostly to Washington. So we have 56 that are left in those 6 states that have passed that level of examination. Those are the college graduates. So that it isn't an absence of candidates, it's again the quality of education. Now we have to keep working to attract better students.
How is that percentage compared to what the white?
The whites in the South would pass on an average of about 26% in those states.
6%.
The Negroes here are down around
1,586. And you know that the whites who take this examination are at the lower level of the whites.
Oh, they're far and away the lower level.
So in fact, they're probably the upper level of the Negroes.
The New England percentage in the same examination passing is almost 50%.
There was 1 or 2% Negro passages.
Yeah. This is 6 southeastern states. These are the 7 southeastern.
So that indicates that in addition to getting everybody thinking about it, how are we going to handle the civil service part of it?
Well, I think we've got to provide some special authorities which will permit us to actually go out and select Negroes. That's what we're doing in Birmingham today.
How do we get around the examination?
Well, these would be. These would be to fill positions where we do not have examinations at the moment. And then we'll have to establish new examinations which will give the Negroes a better break at the level of their capability.
Can you do anything for a fellow who's already in the post office as a janitor but has a college degree to put him into some other agency without a brand new exam?
We can to some jobs, and that's why we're examining these college graduates. Now, we're screening your
I think that's a valid